Greetings, Future Now listeners. Welcome back to IFTF's podcast, where we select guests who help us challenge the common myths and collective fears about our future. These folks and our staff hosts hope to instill optimism and ignite your imagination for possibility. I'm Jean Hagen, IFTF executive producer. And in this episode, host Marina Gorbis, RED, talks with former IFTF fellow and longtime collaborator, Natalie Foster, co-founder of the Economic Security Project. Natalie's new book, The Guarantee, Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy, is a vision for building a more just, inclusive, and resilient economy. She asks us to imagine that healthcare, housing, a college education, and dignified work are not only attainable by all, but a guaranteed right by our government. Sounds like a moonshot, right? Well, Natalie chronicles the subtle shifts that are already happening today, from the expansion of the child care credit to the cancellation of student debt. She and Marina also talk about her time at IFTF and how the gift of learning foresight led her to look for signals of change and use her values of community, dignity, and optimism to imagine better policies and a better economy for all Americans. I have so much respect for Natalie and her enthusiasm about the possibilities for a more humane America. I know she'll inspire you too. Enjoy.
Welcome, Natalie Foster.
Thank you, Marina. It is such a joy to be here with you.
It's great to be in conversation with you. So your book is out. It's called Guarantee, and it's published by New Press. The subtitle is Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. You are the co-founder of the Economic Security Project. You are one of our first Future for Good fellows at IFTF, and we worked really closely for the last 10 years, I think, maybe more, on everything related to future work and equitable work. We've been on panels and talking about this stuff that seemed really crazy and early to people at that time, and it's all happening now today. But let's start with a book. What's the book about?
I will tell you what the book is about, but first I want to say to you, thank you. You know, that year of being at, an Institute for the Future, Future Good Fellow, was really instrumental to me. I learned so much from you. I learned so much from the Institute. And in the back of my book, I actually say, you know, sitting there sort of seeing that quote, the future is here, but it's unevenly distributed, was very, very influential to me. And so this book, just to think about kind of the language of foresight a little bit, this book, you know, you taught me to look for signals of the future. And that's what I've been doing over the past 10 years, building and watching the signals. And I now believe we've moved from signals to a paradigm shift. And so that's really what I'm chronicling in the book. It introduces what I call the guarantee economy, in which the government ensures all of America's basic needs, economic needs, are met. It is the economy that we deserve in America, in the richest nation on earth, in the richest moment in history. And the book offers proof of concept that over the last few years, there has been an incredible sea change afoot toward a guarantee economy. And I get into that. I get into the paradigm shift and the architects who've laid the groundwork over the last decade plus to get us to that point when the pandemic would hit, political opening would happen, and policymakers would reach for ideas that were lying around. These ideas had been tested, they had been tried, and they would become the law of the land, getting us closer to a guarantee economy.
So let's talk about specifics. What kind of guarantees? What should we be guaranteed in this country?
Well, what I'm doing in the book is offering the paradigm that this is what the economy should be organized around. This is our principle. And I track 7 economic guarantees to show how much progress they've made moving from the margins to the mainstream. So let me give some examples. When we saw the National Guard mobilize and put free vaccines in people's arms and make emergency care around COVID free and send free tests through the mail to be able to test for this raging pandemic, that was a healthcare guarantee. When the government purchased hotels and moved the unhoused in and sent rental subsidies to help people stay in their home and mortgage subsidies to help people stay in their home and an eviction moratorium that held people during a great, great crisis in this nation, the first of its kind, that was a housing guarantee. When the government sent checks to every parent in America through the expanded child tax credit, which parents would, you know, Congress would pass this bill, the IRS would get the checks out a few weeks later, helping parents with the basics of life. That is an income guarantee. So these are the types of guarantees we've seen in the last few years, and the groundwork has been steadily laid by architects over the last, you know, prior to that to get us to this point.
So it's basically basic levels of access to healthcare, fundamental healthcare, access to housing, access to income, base level of incomes. What else?
The ones I track in the book, and look, I'm not saying these are the seven. There could be more. Yeah. I'm just saying these are the things I'm seeing. We talk about healthcare and getting us to a healthcare guarantee that, you know, we as a nation spend more on healthcare than any other developed world and get worse care than anywhere else in the developed world. A housing guarantee that so many families can barely afford to stay in their homes. And we are not building anymore in America. So we are 6 million units short to house people. So getting us closer to a housing guarantee, the guarantee of good work, the guarantee of family care, right? The work that allows for all work to happen in this country to care for children, for elders, for people with disabilities. It's an infrastructure that's needed. And the care guarantee is much more mainstream and possible and happening in many places, you know, than it was years ago. The guarantee of college. We can talk about some of the student debt cancellation that has gotten us closer to this understanding what a college guarantee would look like, the guarantee of income, and finally, a guaranteed inheritance. The idea that every child born should have a trust at birth that they have when they get older, and it's often called a baby bond, but that's the seventh one I track.
That's great. And I can think of other guarantees, but I think the seven are the basics.
Like what, Marina?
I guess, no, you got it. I'm just thinking about land and land ownership and how it's a form of asset. I can think about sort of community as a social community and kind of how important it is in terms of giving us access and support in many ways. But I think you cover all the basic ones, which is great.
Just to say, your worker on universal basic assets, I think, was very helpful to me as I was thinking over the years. You know, it was expanding on the universal basic income conversation and saying it needs to be much broader. And I thought, I want to make sure I lift up that body of work. So it was really important.
Right, because really, when we look about, as you know, and we've talked about a lot, when you look at income inequalities, there are great income inequalities. But if you look at wealth inequalities, they're 10 times greater. And wealth is really dependent on all these assets. What you're talking about as guarantees, I think of them as basic assets. They're assets, they're kind of resources that are fundamental to a person or a family or household having a good life and being able to thrive and defining their opportunities. One thing I always wonder about, in many countries, in many places of the world, people are given these guarantees and they think of them as rights. And it's not questionable to them that they need to have access to some of those things, free education, free college education. Look at places like Germany, or very, very affordable education. Healthcare, of course, is a guarantee in many places. In places like Iceland, basic level of incomes, all of these things. How did we get into this mindset that we conceive of these things as commodities that we buy? We have to pay their private assets. How did we get into the space where here in the United States, people don't think of them as something that is part of being a citizen, part of being a member of this society? You deserve these kind of guarantees.
You know, in the late 40s, a group of people got together at the Mont Pelerin Society, and they were concerned about freedom, which frankly, so am I. But they had a very different take on freedom, and they felt like, how do we make sure that government is as unintrusive as possible? And they would write a statement of principles that would become the intellectual groundwork for trickle-down economics, for Reaganomics, for neoliberalism, call it what you will. But the last 50 years of economic policymaking have been marked by three tenets: total faith in the market, zero faith in government, and people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And that last piece is a pervasive myth that Oompa Bhattacharya and Anne Price at the Maven Collaborative call toxic individualism, that we have told a story in this country that everything is up to you. It is your responsibility. And if you fail, it's your fault. So over the years, things like college have gone from a public good, right? It is a good thing for society to have an educated populace who has spent time thinking about the big questions of the world or is schooled in like the letters and the humanities and the sciences. And instead, we've shifted it to be a personal investment that you take out astronomical amounts of debt to hopefully pay back. The problem is, well, there's many problems, but one of them is that you then, anyone over the last 50 years has graduated into a job market with stagnating wages. So there's not even a return on the investment, much less a fundamental misconception of college as a public good. And this is true as the cost of health. And by the way, we're recording this conversation at a moment when college has reached $100,000 a year. That is out of anyone's grasp and is a world where a very small number of people will be able to access what should be a public good.
So it's kind of remarkable that during that period of the pandemic, which was a really stressful time for all of us and for the country and for our society, for everything, that it ended up being the space for actually showing on a smaller scale how these guarantees can actually change people's lives and how valuable they are. So talk about that. Like, how did that happen? And what did we learn during that period of 2 years almost? And by the way, now we're back to the pre-pandemic. So the rates of child poverty are skyrocketing again. Something like, I don't know if you saw this data, something like one out of four children in New York is living below the poverty level. And so how did we manage to do it and then kind of taking it away? And what does it tell us about the future?
I think that the end of the trickle-down economics era, I would date to like 2008. And that is when it became clear that the last 50 years of economic policymaking had left us broke, in debt, stressed, and our democracy on the brink. I believe we've been in a transition period since then. And in that transition period, there have been architects steadily laying the groundwork to say a different economy is possible. We have a choice as a nation. We can pursue an austere, much more authoritarian form of an economy, or we can take this richest moment in history and the richest nation on earth and create a world where there's abundance. And people had been laying that groundwork over years. And when the pandemic hit there, and you had a president like Joe Biden in office, who, by the way, is so old, he's what, 81? He's pre-neoliberal. He's pre the era of Reaganomics. He remembers a moment when government had a role in creating the middle class. Now, they did it in a way that left Black and brown communities out. That will be a stain we live with for a long time and can change as we think about the future of a new deal in America. But he remembers that era. So you have this president who understands things can look different. You have people in motion around a new economy. And when the pandemic hits, he legislates differently than anything I've seen in my lifetime. He starts to cancel millions and millions, if not billions of dollars of student debt to give people a taste of what it would feel like to live without that ball and chain from your education for decades. He, you know, sends tests through the mail and makes healthcare free and gets vaccines. He and Donald Trump, to be fair, both. You know, Donald Trump launched Operation Warp Speed, which was government saying we will pay for the vaccines. We will move it faster than ever before. We will support the R&D and, you know, made sure that private companies were able to do what they do and get those out incredibly fast, the fastest vaccine we've, you know, seen in history. Government played a really important role in that. So it's a different, it's a sea change in economic policymaking. And you're right, a lot has expired as we have, you know, kind of fallen back into the old ways and we've let partisan gridlock take over. But I'm hopeful that the point of the book is that we did it in America. You started this question by pointing to international examples. And that's what I'd always thought, Marina. Like, you know, I grew up in Kansas, daughter of a preacher, a high school debater, and I would read stories of people in Vienna and how they lived in housing that was built by the government. It was kept off the speculative market. 80% of people in Vienna live in this housing and are, that is, you know, thousands of dollars a month to spend on your life. What did you say?
Social housing.
Yes, social housing. I would read these stories. I would read stories of what it looks like to have healthcare in Canada or in the UK where you have something like a cancer diagnosis and you do not go into extreme debt or have to run a GoFundMe from your friends and family to support the life-giving medicines that you need. And I thought, well, that is something other countries do, not here. Yeah. Right. And that's what's different right now, that if you want to talk about social housing, you don't have to go to Vienna. You go to Montgomery County, Maryland, where the housing authority there has built hundreds of units and has plans to build many more, kept off the speculative market, sitting densely, you know, right on the metro line in DC, and making sure that middle-income families have an affordable place to live. It is happening now in the US.
Yeah, and what I love about your book, among many things, is that you combine these sort of high-level concepts, policy ideas, but you tell them through the eyes and through the experiences of real people who are leading these kinds of changes. So talk about that. I always think like my survival strategy right now, which we all know we're living in very stressful time and with all kinds of potential apocalyptic scenarios that people love to talk about. And my survival strategy is to talk to people like you and people who are our fellows, who I think of as like these practical visionaries, like Saket Sani and Ai-Jin Poo and you and Esteban Kelly, who are just, despite all of it, are just doing amazing things in the world. And that just, I think it's like my cure right now. It's my serotonin lifter. So talk about these people and how important it is to really amplify their stories and elevate these people who are doing this amazing work.
Mm, I hear you. Well, my serotonin lifter is a quote from Mariam Makaba, that hope is a discipline, that it is not, you know, something that will always come naturally or easy, particularly in these dark times, but it is a discipline and a muscle, right, that we work to hold on to. Because in order to build this economy that I'm naming, you have to believe it's possible. And those, you know, Mont Pelerin Society, free marketeers in 1947, who were living in a very different world then, believed something was possible and set it in motion and changed the course of history. Surely, those of us who believe a world of abundance is possible can do the same thing, but we have to hope and believe, and it's hard, undoubtedly. So let me tell you a story of a young student at Stanford near the Institute for the Future headquarters in Palo Alto, who would sit in the Stanford library and read Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s last book. And he'd make notes in the margin about some of the big ideas Dr. King was talking about to abolish poverty. And his name was Michael Tubbs. And he would take that book to Stockton where he would become one of the youngest mayors in American history. He would take that dog-eared book and he would say, I want to do some of these things. I want to show that what Dr. King was talking about in the late 60s is possible in America today. And so I would meet him around that time. My team at the Economic Security Project would join forces, and Mayor Michael Tubbs would launch the first modern demonstration of a guaranteed income in Stockton. And it would pierce the heart of the trickle-down economics policymaking that says, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that says government has no role, and that the private market will solve everything. It would pierce straight to the heart of that. And people would take notice. Media from all over the world would come to Stockton to talk to people, the 125 families who had received $500 a month with no strings attached. Something as simple as $500 a month would create significant shifts in the precarity that people were feeling in Stockton. And mayors would take note and they would text Michael Tubbs. Around this time, Dr. Aisha Yandaro was doing the same thing in Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, nonprofit leaders would text Aisha and say, what are you doing? And these two leaders would open up their playbooks. They would open source them. They would invite others in. And a sea change would happen. We would start to see cities and counties across America demonstrating what a guaranteed income would look like in American policy, sitting alongside wages, sitting alongside the rest of the safety net, how it would shore up things like income volatility in this low-wage nation, this precarious nation in which we live. The pandemic would hit. Policymakers would look for ideas. The mayors, the counties, it's a tried and tested idea. And they would start to send stimulus checks. They would pass the expanded child tax credit, which sent every parent a check, just like Michael Tubbs had been doing years before in Stockton, California. So that is an example of a person who believed, who is an excellent organizer, who was resourced to organize, built organization to hold the growth and the expansion and the power that was being accumulated, would build the intellectual framework needed to pass policy and to get it done.
Perfect illustration of that Milton Friedman quote, you have to have a lot of ideas lying around waiting for the right moment to move to the center.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I actually took a lot of inspiration from that quote. You know, Milton Friedman and his crew did it well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like Joe Biden and Michael Tubbs and their crew, our crew, is doing that now.
And speaking of that moment, so the New Deal came out at the time when there was a lot of just desperation, pure desperation in this country. Levels of unemployment, like over 20%, so much poverty, people, so much social upheaval. And so it's almost like when everything else fails, we do these really bold initiatives and bold thinking. We sort of go into something that's very different from the past, right? Are we at that moment? And what I worry about is that when do we reach that moment? You know, what levels of poverty do we need to achieve? Or are we at that moment now? And did we learn anything from these 80 years of experience past the New Deal?
One of the things I really appreciated at my Institute for the Future era was imagining all the different scenarios in the future. And, you know, there's one scenario where the rapid advances in artificial intelligence makes very big changes and disruptions to the workforce. Certainly all jobs won't go away, but it will really shift the jobs people have. And I feel like there are, you know, disruption after disruption after disruption possible on the horizon. What I want us to do is be ready for that moment. And we won't be starting from scratch. You know, I would argue, yes, we are in that moment now. There's no, people in power get to decide when it's an emergency and when it's not. There's so many reasons to say there's an emergency today. Let's bring in the measures that would shore up the, you know, the numbers really bear it out. People feel very precarious. People feel very unsettled right now.
Even though the overall indicators are looking pretty good, but people don't feel it. They feel that precarity because it could change in a moment. And most of the jobs have become precarious.
That's right. Right. As this nation has become a low-wage nation, low-wage jobs come without many of the protections, many of the wage guarantees, right? You never often know how many hours you're going to get a week. Therefore, you don't know what your paycheck's going to look like a week. And when you are living very dollar to dollar, that matters a lot. And that precarity is scary. But even beyond the debt one has to take to go to college, to buy a home, to buy a car is extraordinary. And so people live with debt, they live with fear. And the story, the myth that we tell ourselves is that it's our fault. And so people also experience a lot of shame. And when we feel shame, we can't trust. We can't trust institutions. We can't trust people, the government. And when we can't trust, it's hard to have a democracy.
Yeah.
And when we don't participate because we don't trust, it reinforces and furthers that economic precarity because those people are then not participating in the economic system, and it's a downward spiral. So what I want to see is the upward spiral where people feel more economically secure, can trust, can engage, and start to say, wait a second, why does that corporation take off with this much? You know, why am I left holding the bag here? Why do these tax cuts, which by the way, the Trump tax cuts, which gave massive giveaways to the biggest corporations in America and the wealthiest people will expire next year. So there will be a big fight for the future of the tax code. And tax codes are moral documents. So people will be able to have the room and the space to say, why is that the way it is? And fight for what they deserve. That's the upward spiral between, you know, economic security and democracy that I believe we could usher in.
Yeah. And so speaking, you asked the question, what guarantees I would like to see.
Yes.
There's one that you just brought up, AI, artificial intelligence, in general, digital tools. And I keep thinking, we keep talking about how AI is going to reshape everything, which is true, it can. But these technologies operate in social and policy context. We would have very different outcomes if these were public goods, if they were public infrastructure, they would shape things very, very differently. So how are you thinking about that? Or are you thinking about AI and digital technologies?
Tools? Yes, I am. You know, my team at the Economic Security Project has been thinking a lot about this. Broadly, there is a lot of concentration, market concentration up and down the AI stack. And one of the ways you can deal with this is through antitrust regulation, enforcement, but also public auctions, to your point. And I'm very excited to see a bill Scott Wiener has in California that, among many other things and guardrails it would create for AI, it also includes a public option for a cloud called Cal Compute.
Yep.
And that is, to me, a signal of an understanding that government has to play a stronger role in ensuring the guardrails and access and equity to these new technologies. Because we know what happens when we don't. And that's the last several decades of Web 2.0 and the rising social media that was just left completely to the market. And now we're living in that world. And it's those exact same players that stand to gain in this new AI moment and have really are the incumbents already in this new
which
AI.
Are part, once you become an incumbent, it's harder to displace you. Once you build out the whole infrastructure, it's harder to take it back. But that notion of public option in so many areas, you can talk about in terms of digital infrastructure, AI, we can talk about it in terms of health, and access to health, education, all of these other things that we needed as an option to make the other side better, right?
Yes.
To make it more competitive. And I think Robert Reich talks about it, that, you know, survival of capitalism depends on a really vibrant public sector because it provides kind of a guardrails and provides some competition to this unbridled search for return on investments.
That's right. It shapes the market. That's what my colleague Chris Hughes calls it and is writing a book on that concept. And that is a role government should have, to shape a market and ensure that it can be competitive. Competitive so that people can afford the goods. Competitive so that people are able to access it and people can afford, and their lives are made better by the fact that they can afford the insulin, or they can afford to go to school, or any of the things that public options might offer.
But that's so important for people to understand, because we've been taught that market is something that's just natural. It just appears. It's preordained. It's the way things work. And I don't think a lot of people really understand that the market, it's a game, right? And the rules of the game are shaped by us, by policies, by all kinds of things. It's not something preordained. I think it's really important. You know, I remember there was a day before the pandemic when you organized, the Economic Security Project organized a gathering in San Francisco about universal basic income. And it was such a wonderful, wonderful to see all these people in one room and talking about what they're doing. And Michael Tubbs was there. And I always think of you as that person who brings people together to move ideas and to also give them a feeling that they're not alone, that there are actually a whole community of people. That's kind of my dream, have always been at the Institute, like, let's bring all these people into one room and see what we can do together. Like, how do you see your role right now in this moment?
That's such a great question. And you're right that what's called CashCon was very instrumental to me in many ways. One, it's where Michael Tubbs and Baratunde Thurston would take to the stage. Baratunde was emceeing the event, and Michael Tubbs would announce he was going to do a demonstration in Stockton. And two, it's where Saket Soni, who you referenced earlier, who's written an excellent book and that everyone should read, we both love it, he would say, the big idea here is guarantee. The guarantee, the big idea here is guaranteeing economic security, and that should be a right in the 21st century. And that really stuck with me as we were debating even what to call it. Is it UBI? Is it guaranteed income? Much less sort of the heart of it all. And that would stay with me. And of course, you know, animate the work. And then eventually, little did I know, become the title of a book that I would write years later. So that gathering has been meaningful to me. And look, I'll say, I really believe in the old adage, right? Like, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go further, go together. And I think that has always been true in my work. Yeah, I was trained as a community organizer, which I took naturally to, as the daughter of a preacher, right? Bringing together people around a shared purpose and a shared vision. And that's influenced so much of what I do today. And so, you know, frankly, how do I see my role? I'm one part a builder, a field builder, and I daily am amazed and proud by the guaranteed income work that has grown across the country. But I also am a bit of a scout. I am, and as I put my head up, you know, from our guaranteed income building work, I realized the momentum we've seen moving this idea from the margins to the mainstream, each of these other economic rights, economic issues had also seen. So Aijin Poo, who's been doing this work longer than I have and who has laid the groundwork for care in America, was seeing extraordinary progress, you know, to the point where Rose Garden events seem to be happening each month around a care guarantee in America. And millions of dollars have gone into starting to build what that would look like. That Solana Rice, a longtime advocate around the racial wealth gap and for racial justice and economic justice, would see her idea of a baby bond grow and then become law in states like Connecticut and California and Washington, D.C. And so I wanted to chronicle that progress somewhere and lift up, you know, the work I was seeing and pull it together in the paradigm. So that's the book.
And I guess one reason I'm asking this, just yesterday, I'm in conversations with lots of foundations and lots of nonprofits, all kind of trying to create a better, more equitable world. And I think a lot of strategic plans are being thrown out right now, because despite all of that, and a lot of people trying to change things, change is slow. And we're not seeing the kind of changes that we've been advocating and, you know, foundations have been investing in and others for decades also. What do you think? Are we missing something here?
My view is that something extraordinary has happened over the last few years when it comes to economic policymaking. I think a couple of things. One, we have something like an announcement that billions of dollars of student debt are being canceled, which is extraordinary. People didn't believe the government could do that. They thought this is just the way it has to be. No, that is not true. It is proving that there is a different way possible. The same week that we, you know, have our right to an abortion being rolled back in the state of Arizona. So it is absolutely true that we have to hold the steps forward and the steps backward at the same time. But part of the work is that when something is happening and working and there's progress, is to name it and not walk away. Like, what I am seeing is, I hope the floor for an entirely new house that we're building. Like, imagine back early in the, you know, era of Reagan, they were just getting started, and it would guide economic policymaking for decades to come. I think we're in that moment, and history books will look back and say it was, you know, the pandemic era that laid the groundwork for a new economic paradigm. And decades after that, you would have, you know, lawmakers follow suit and build on that, that it's not the end, it's the beginning. And so we have to nurture and build on that beginning. And there's been a lot of people who've invested in economic paradigm shift, Hewlett Foundation, Omidyar Foundation. And I hope those foundations continue to do, you know, that kind of work, because it takes a long time for stories to be told and progress to be understood. The last thing I'll say here is that the progress we're talking about is big, right? It takes some time. So I just got to hear from some construction workers down south, part of the LIUNA Construction Union, the LIUNA Union. And they are now have jobs at this manufacturing plant that are coming out of the IRA. Now, IRA, it's called the Inflation Reduction Act, which was named for the economic worry of the time, but actually was an industrial policy bill that would say government has a role.
I don't think a lot of people realize how revolutionary that piece of legislation is, and partially because it's so complex and it has so many elements to it that I don't think people really understand how it's the biggest piece of legislation since the New Deal in terms of benefiting workers. Yeah, so.
Absolutely. And it's a climate legislation, has a climate lens. And these workers are part of a plant. And they were saying, I cannot tell you what it feels like to go from $15 an hour to $25 an hour with benefits. It was the joy on their faces of saying, I can get Invisalign for my children. I've been able to put a down payment on a house for my mom, which I never believed was possible in my life. There was joy, there was optimism, there was hope. And it's an extraordinary thing to see people feeling their own agency because they have more economic security. And that is from legislation passed 2 years ago. And so I think we are just at the beginnings of what it will mean and what it will mean in people's lives. So we have to hold tight.
Yeah. Do you have, and I hate to bring up kind of the negative scenario, but how are you thinking if in terms of the next election and what will happen if Biden is not elected and we're back to tax cuts and all the other things that happened before? Do you have a strategy you're working on for that?
Well, I think that this next election needs to be a contest for the future. Joe Biden needs to point out what he's done, but also what he will do. And I also think in this election, people need to see themselves as the heroes of the story. So part of what he's done is because so many activists and advocates laid the groundwork. For me, it is a direct line between the young climate activists who did a sit-in in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's office and would launch the Green New Deal, which is largely derided at this point as a political, you know, non-starter. But what they were calling for was a structural shift. They were calling for industrial policy. They were calling for a new approach to climate and climate justice in this country, all of which you see in the IRA. I believe it created the political opening for something like the IRA to pass. And so I really think that and hope activists see themselves as, you know, the hero in this story for this election. And I think the stakes really couldn't be higher. I think the other side has made it abundantly clear exactly what types of democracy they plan to dismantle, freedoms to roll back, not to mention, you know, and all of that will be possible because a tax code that will continue to further concentrate the wealth that would fund the abundance we could have in this country, but instead would be in the hands of a few small people. And we now know that if we don't shift, we will have a trillionaire this decade. This is according to Oxfam, some data that came out a few months ago. I had to do a little understanding of what a trillionaire is, Marina.
I don't think our brains are capable of even containing that.
It is a million millions.
Right.
It is 1,000 billions. It is more money controlled by one person than many, many, many countries, including Ireland, on this globe. It's not even fathomable. So, and so when people say to me, how are we going to pay for this? You know, you just need to point to that. That is making sure that doesn't happen is how we pay for the good life in this country.
So thank you so much for this conversation. As I said, being surrounded by people who are doing things like you and Socket and others is just like my serotonin lifter, which I need on this morning. But just in closing, what are you focusing on right now besides the book and talking about the book?
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you the same question, Marina, so get ready. I'm just going to have to say the book. You know, I feel I'm the mother of two. And this is like my third baby, and it's been gestating for 2 years. So I'm like an elephant, which have 2 year gestation periods. And it's now getting born into the world. It publishes April 23rd. And I'm just really excited to talk about what's in the book and so many of the visionaries and architects I've had the joy of spending time with and watching their work grow and what it's meant in people's lives. And how about you? What are you spending time on?
Oh my gosh. Thinking about the future and obviously lots of conversations at the Institute about AI. And in some ways, I feel like my work has been continuing for the last 15 years, which is thinking about equitable forms of organizing work and not even work, but equitable ways of distributing people's prosperity. And I'm particularly that public option. I keep thinking about different models for that. And thinking a lot about particularly creative and knowledge work, because we've gone through industrial revolution, which really increased productivity, but changed really very fundamentally how people basically created wage work. And now we're going into another really very substantial transformation in terms of how people work, but this time impacting a lot of creative and knowledge work. So, and we need to get ahead of that.
Can I leave you with one signal on public option that's very apropos around, we're recording this right now around tax day, and the IRS has rolled out this year a public option for tax filing. You can choose to use your commercial tax filers if you want, but you can also now use a low cost, it's free in this case, high quality option by the government to file your taxes for free. And this morning, they rolled out pre-population, which means that they can, the government, which knows if you have simple taxes, exactly how much you make already. So the idea that we have to go pay someone to tell the government what they already know is just mind-blowing and has been true in part because of many of the companies want to, you know, keep it that way because it's lucrative. And today they rolled out pre-population, which if you have simple taxes, the government will tell you, this is what you filed last year. Is this still accurate? You check a box, getting us so much closer to how other countries file taxes and via a public option, which many people thought was impossible. So I leave you with that as one signal.
That's a great signal. And thank you so much for reminding all of us to file our taxes. It's just before tax day. And look at the public option. Thank you, Natalie. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Marina. Thank you for your friendship and your mentorship over all these years. I've learned so much from you and the Institute, and I'm grateful for what you all do.
Thanks so much for listening. Institute for the Future is the world's oldest continuously running futures research and educational organization. At IFTF, we believe people can harness the power of imagination to awaken a sense of agency in their own futures and drive change in themselves and their organizations. Be sure to subscribe to the Future Now podcast and find out more about IFTF by visiting iftf.org. Until next time.